So that paragraph, but in fact the cause of this impression must necessarily be sought, is on what page?
343 on my book. It's probably going to be about 313 or so on yours, I think.
Yeah, no, I have mine. In mine, it's 296, but that's a really old edition. So, you know, so long as you know where it is, that's where we are. So to bring us into this particular paragraph, we are in chapter 2 of this part of the book, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. And Sri Aurobindo has already introduced these terms, and he has introduced them in relation to the previous chapter, which introduces the notion of a radical infinite that is indeterminable, that cannot be bound by any rules or laws, but yet that is experienced as a world that contains determinations within it. So this world, or rather cosmos, this presentation of a ordered reality as the cosmos, and at the same time the presentation of a multiplicity, an infinite variability to that cosmos, give us room for all kinds of theories that ultimately try to explain an enigma. Sri Aurobindo is starting with looking at that enigma as something which is, you know, which has invisible powers behind it. And ultimately moves all the way down to a unity. So this unity, which is, he is drawing from the Upanishads and calling it the Brahman, the only thing there is yet appearing in these forms. This is his thesis. And to test that thesis, he has pushed us into certain forms of experience or intuition about certain forms of experience. Now here he is extending that line of thinking into seeing how it is that the relations between these three, an absolute freedom of indeterminability, a cosmos that seems to carry determinations in itself, and a multiplicity in which infinite variability can exist, how are they tied together? And the way he's doing it is no longer philosophical from what we can call an ontological sense. In other words, he's not just describing reality or describing being in terms of its various constituents, but he's describing it from a psychological point of view. Because if indeed this entire self-presentation is that of a conscious being, then we can explain it in terms of consciousness. And since we ourselves are conscious, we should be able to see it in terms of our relationship to that conscious being. Not just a single relationship, but a complex relationship. A complex relationship that includes and explains the three major terms in which this self-presentation is occurring, that of the freedom of a radically infinite indeterminable being, that of what appears to be an ordered cosmos, and that of the infinite you know, division, divisibility of beings in that cosmos. So to do that, he has now introduced three terms, or rather three sets of terms. These are Brahman and Maya, Ishvara and Shakti, and Purusha and Prakriti. And he's talking about them in both in terms of a Western philosophical language, but more properly, he is pulling us into another kind of domain, which is the domain of the history of terminology in Sanskrit, forming the discourse of yoga. Now, this is one of the first things that we need to clarify, because he doesn't make clear why he is doing this. He just tells us that it's more appropriate, it's more explanatory than to use the Western terms. And we've discussed this a little bit last time, in that the Western terms come with their own baggage. They come with a history of division of a creator and a created. But the Indian terms are coming with a different kind of history. Firstly, they are coming with the history of yoga. That is, all this philosophy really, serves a purpose. That purpose is, how can we relate to that? What kind of relation can we find between ourselves and that, which can bridge through consciousness that which seems to be incompatible or divided? So it may be brought to mind that the way in which he is presenting this is also not a unitary history looked at it from the Indian point of view. The three sets of terms he has introduced, Brahman and Maya, Ishvara and Shakti, and Purusha and Prakriti, each belong to a separate strand and a separate stratum of Indian psychological yoga, or psychological theory of yoga. Brahman and Maya are well known to be part of the Upanishads. They are foregrounded by the Upanishads. They are introduced by the Upanishads. And that introduction is something new when it appears in the Upanishads. And it appears partly in contradistinction to the previous body of texts dealing with something beyond, a conscious being beyond, and that is the Vedas. So Brahman makes its appearance in the Upanishads as a psychophilosophical concept related to the foregrounding of the unity, and actually not even unity, the monism, I'd say, of reality. In other words, there is only one thing. To foreground that and make it clear that all the various gods that are worshipped in the Vedas are nothing if not by the power of that, this term Brahman is introduced, and the self-conceiving power of Brahman is introduced as Maya. Now that also is something that we need to take a moment to, consider, which is that in establishing any kind of a relation within itself, if there is only one reality, which is conscious, self-conscious, it must present itself. This is ultimately what the whole chapter is about, and this whole section is about. How does that radical monism present itself? And it must not present itself as something which is occurring in time, as something which began at a certain point and will end at a certain point, but something which is a essential condition of being. In other words, this self-presentation in terms of a psychological reality is itself an ontology. It is being's own self-presentation. A self-presentation of that kind can only be a self-perception. In other words, as a basic condition of being, this one indeterminable being perceives itself in a variety of ways, in infinite ways, because it is infinite. And from all the various ways that it may perceive itself as an ordered cosmos. If it does perceive itself as an ordered cosmos, it seems to be limiting itself, because in a way, it is indeterminable. So how is it appearing as a determined reality? Well, it is not really appearing as a determined reality. It is appearing as a reality in which determinations occur. And at the same time, such a self-presentation evidences the self-knowledge of being. If it is knowing itself, then it can view itself as an ordered reality, as one of the varieties of self-knowing. So, in trying to present itself, this self-perception implies a duality within itself. That's the primary tenet of this chapter, that Brahman, if it were to exist only in self-absorption, would not need to present itself in any way. But Brahman, because it is conscious, can turn its consciousness upon itself to look at itself in infinite ways. This self-perception of the One is already a duality within the One. It's the mirroring of the Self. And that's why there is a primary or radical duality within the monism. So this is the one and the two. There are some modern philosophers, and some people say it arises out of Zen, in trying to describe or trying to react to the charge that it deals with a nothingness, has said, no, that's not the right way of talking about it. The right way of talking about it is that it is not one and not two. See, in other words, it encompasses and yet transcends these two self-descriptions, but includes them. It is one and two, and not one and not two. So here is the notion of Brahman as a radically infinite indeterminable that is presenting itself and hence is perceiving itself, and through these self-perceptions is evidencing a radical duality within itself, the duality of being and consciousness, the power of consciousness which is describing to itself what being is. So we find that Brahman and the power of self-conception of Brahman, which is Maya, are the primary realities, and these make their appearance in the Upanishads. But just by themselves, they do not explain completely why there is an ordered cosmos and why there are infinite beings that each have a separate reality. So for that, we must say that these two, Brahman and Maya, are taking a certain station as cosmic being and cosmic power. the energy of the cosmos. This is Ishvara and Shakti. Now, the idea of Ishvara and Shakti arises somewhat later. The term Ishvara itself has its origins in the Upanishads. But this pairing of Ishvara and Shakti occurs a good deal later in a very prominent way from about the 4th century in India. And the body of texts in which this happens are known as the Agamas. The Agamas are connected to the Puranas. The Agamas really form the basis of what we call Hinduism today. The Agamas are related to the main gods, Vishnu and Shiva, and to the goddess, who we call Devi. A goddess may have many names. In the 4th century, she appears as Durga, and also as Lakshmi, Saraswati, and then there are a number of other variants. And later, this body of text that foregrounds the Shakti becomes known as Tantra. So the Agamas, which are originally a kind of a tantric Puranism, and we can call the whole set of Agamas into a kind of theistic Vedanta, foregrounds Ishvara and Shakti. On the one hand, we move into Shaivism, and on the other hand, we move into Vaishnavism, and then we have Tantra. And then we have another description of reality, which is being provided. We are not really sure at what time, but by the time the Agamas appear, they are already well established. So the Agamas themselves are drawing on both Vedanta and that other body of explanation, which is called Sankhya. The Agamas post-date the Gita, and the Gita already is uniting or trying to synthesize these three realities. Rather, one is the Vedanta. The Gita sees itself as a Vedanta. The other is Sankhya. Throughout the Gita is talking about explaining reality in terms of Sankhya. And at the same time, it is introducing the notion of a theism, a God who is Purushottama, Supreme Person, Parameshwara, Supreme Lord, and Paramatman, Supreme Self. So this kind of a bridging between the three sort of strata, one may say, of explanation has occurred by the time of the Gita, but it is not made very clear. The Gita does not foreground the Shakti. It keeps using the term Paraprakriti without very clearly defining what it is. One knows that it is, in a way, the cosmic, more person aspect of the Maya. So, this is where we are at present. I don't want to go very further because Sri Aurobindo will clarify some of these ideas as we go along. But essentially, these are the three kinds of realities. Oh, I just wanted to add that as far as Sankhya is concerned, Sankhya rests on a phenomenology of duality. So Sankhya is talking about our experience, which seems to be a dualistic experience. In this experience, whatever it is that being is, which we can call something conscious, conscious being, is not entirely our experience of phenomena in the world. Our experience of phenomena includes gradations of unconsciousness, ultimately going down to a absolute unconsciousness, what Sri Aurobindo calls an inconscience. So, how does one relate these gradations of unconsciousness to something which we intuit within ourselves as conscious? They say that these are two distinct realities, Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha and Prakriti are intertwined in the cosmos. And yet, they are not united. They don't arise from the same source. So in a way, Sankhya is a little like modern science and the philosophy of modern science, which sees consciousness as an epiphenomenon of matter. So it has, though they don't see it as an epiphenomenon, they see it as distinct from matter. And hence, it is something that needs to extricate itself from the laws of unconsciousness. And in doing so, when it achieves that, it knows reality as Sankhya proposes reality truly is, a distinct witnessing conscious being and a variety of automatisms, which are what it calls Prakriti or nature. So how do you bridge these three? The Gita has made its attempt to do the same. Yet the terminology of the Gita has not properly united these three levels. There are hidden links in it. Sri Aurobindo has tried to bring out those hidden links in his essays on the Gita. But here he is trying to show us how these three layers of ontology are ultimately one. They only express the radical monism of Brahman. So we can begin from, but in fact, this, the cause of this impression, and the impression that he's talking about is fielded towards the end of the previous paragraph, where he's foregrounding the enigma of these self-appearances, the self-appearance of the indescribable and indeterminable, the sort of determinations of the cosmos, and the independence of the entities within the cosmos. They seem to be incompatible with one another. And if indeed, if they are incompatible with one another, is it a wrong description to try to unite them? Or is it a kind of magic? This is the point that he's making over here, that it would seem that we cannot really explain these in terms of a radical monism, and hence one way of explaining it would be that this is all a magic. And in fact, that kind of explanation has been used. Even somebody as cogent as Shankara, when he talks about Maya, calls it a magician, that it uses a kind of magic to present itself as what we see it in the universe. One other small point, and that is that when I said that cosmos appears to be ordered, it also appears to be disordered. And that is something that over time we have seen in the explanations of cosmos that have emerged in Western science as well as Western philosophy. We have to look at both these realities together, and that's the reason why it begins to become possible to think about freedom existing in the elements of the cosmos and at the same time there being some kind of order in the cosmos. So explanations of the cosmos as being indeterminable have appeared in chaos theory in more recent times. And there are certain philosophers who call cosmos chaosmos. You know, this is a philosopher by the name of Guattari, who worked with Deleuze and Guattari. Guattari uses the term chaosmos for cosmos. And they see cosmos as a evolving reality. that out of this chaos, out of something which cannot be thought about in terms of order, order is emerging. And a lot of these thinkers are talking about a principle of individuation. A principle of individuation implies that somewhere behind this entire chaosmos, there is a single individual. Everything is moving towards the self-realization of this individual as the one in the many. So this is a kind of movement towards the affirmation of chaos as foregrounded, but always in relation with the ordered reality of the single one. On the other hand, we've moved from the 16th century in the opposite direction, affirmed a clockmaker cosmos, and tried to make sense of the amount of, chaos there is within that cosmos. So that's where we find ourselves.
May I ask a couple of questions before we start the reading?
Yeah, sure, John Cornell.
The first one is in regard to the apparent order of the cosmos and the infinite variety of appearances in the cosmos. And I wonder if the infinite variety corresponds to this chaos or indeterminability that you were talking about. So that's the first question. The second one, I think you said something like Indian philosophy was in relation to, was founded in order to facilitate the relationship with the divine or with being. And I wondered if first of all, if that's really what you said and what you meant, and if that there's a similar or a different approach that Western philosophy has taken in its attempts to understand things.
Yeah, John Robert, I think those are both very profound questions. And your first question is more easily answered. The answer is yes. It is. That's why I said that it is not a self-limitation, but a self-presentation. And the self-presentation of a radically infinite being as cosmos includes radical infinity within it. Now, we can talk about variability, which is, if we say that infinite being looks upon itself as a variation of gradations of consciousness, which are infinite, being infinite, even such a variation would be an infinite variation. But even that would not ultimately give full value to the infinite indeterminability of being. That could be understood as a freedom within the elements. In other words, though there is a certain kind of variability of consciousness and variations within each grade of consciousness, we could also say that each expression of those variations contains a freedom. That is what is called free choice. And ultimately, free choice goes all the way down, that there is a certain point in which there is ultimate freedom, though our original understanding of individual freedom is a conditioning. It's an impression of freedom, but really we are conditioned. But if we test the bounds of our freedom, we find that we are absolutely and infinitely free, because the one who is completely indeterminable has appeared in each of its entities. So this is the reason why each entity is interdependent and at the same time free. This is one of the paradoxes that the term chaosmos represents, for example. And that's what we are talking about. So yes, that is how the indeterminability and freedom of Brahman is appearing within the cosmos as chaos. Now, the second question, the answer again is yes, that the what we call philosophy in the Indian context is really not, again, a very good fit with the disciplinary boundaries of that term in the Western academy. And the reason is that what the term translates to in Sanskrit is darshan. Darshan is the term for philosophy in Sanskrit. And darshan literally means to see. As you know, the term darshan is many, probably all of you have heard that term. It's used in a number of contexts. And it literally means to see. So it's, as I said, a self-perception. It's a, or rather, ultimately, it goes down to what is the self-perception by which the self-presentation of being takes place. If we could put it in that, in those terms, we'd arrive at what is darshan. How are we to arrive at it? So darshan exists always along with or as another limb of yoga. Yoga and darshan go together like two wings of a bird. And this does not really happen. Now, so what happens when the other part of your question was how does that relate to the Western understanding of philosophy? So you find that, you know, from around the same time as Sri Aurobindo, there begins a kind of a historiography of Western philosophy. In other words, Western philosophers themselves begin stepping back and looking at the history of Western philosophy to ask that question, what are the boundaries and what are the objects of our inquiry? And when they do this, they start seeing one of the primary people who does this is Martin Heidegger. And what Heidegger is doing is saying that there's an important shift that takes place, and that kind of a shift is amplified over time. The first time that shift takes place is in Greek philosophy around the time of Socrates. And, you know, it's a kind of a hazy process there because Socrates is already considered to be a wisdom teacher. Socrates is drawing on his teacher, who was and a body of teaching that is today called pre-Socratic, to talk about a different kind of philosophy, a kind of philosophy that was completely united with practice and realization. But at the same time, Socrates and the two major philosophers who proceed after Socrates, that is Plato and Aristotle, begin sort of voicing the concerns of philosophy in a new way. And that way is more objectified. And that objectification then keeps increasing over time. And so Heidegger says that a split takes place between the concerns for practice and the concerns for explanation, for knowledge. And other thinkers who can be called Heideggerian, like Michel Foucault, have continued pointing this out, the historiography of philosophy that has ultimately broken it away from the realm of practice, that has made it epistemology, the theory of knowledge that is separate from the theory of practice, praxis. You see. So, in a way, that is one of the problems Sri Aurobindo is dealing with, which is why he keeps pulling into these Indian terms.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Any other questions?
In Michel Foucault's case, just I may add one sentence there. What he points out is that, the Western Academy actually at that switchover point is still fielding a kind of praxis with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. There still is an underlying practice, but the reason the split takes place is because the emphasis becomes know thyself, as you know that famous statement is attributed to Socrates. Know thyself. Now, knowing thyself, once it becomes a primary goal, easily shifts into know the world. See? And what Foucault is saying is that the pre-Socratic view of these things was not primarily to know thyself, but what he calls care of the soul. Care of the soul means essentially attention on the inner being, and the practices by which we become that which we aim to become, which is divine. So becoming divine becomes the goal rather than knowing oneself. Because that split ultimately takes out the practice of self-becoming and pushes it in an objective direction into knowing the world.
Yes, I was just wondering about that split, because know thyself still has a kind of an inward dimension, but when it becomes know the world, which seems like Western philosophy has long been concerned with and Western science has come out of that, is there a point where that happens?
Yeah, because know thyself, the question is, know thyself in relation to what? You see, that's part of the entire duality that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. That whenever you talk about the self, it's already a self-presentation of something that includes a looking at. So, know thyself with relation to what? Are we knowing ourselves with relation to the ground of being? Or are we knowing ourselves in relation to the ground of the world in which we find ourselves? So this duality, this two-facedness of knowing the self, is what ultimately leads to the split. The split takes place over time, and it really becomes the next chapter in the split. The major chapter is in what is called enlightenment thinking. And during enlightenment thinking, because the notion of the order of things becomes foregrounded, we are talking about a rational world, a reasonable cosmos. So knowing oneself becomes an aspect of knowing the order of things in the world. That's what's called the logos. See, so this logos idea is also part of the self-presentation of indeterminable being, as Sri Aurobindo sees it. And one may say, supermind is logos. It is the knowledge organ of the self. But once one makes this split and starts looking at the cosmos as the foundation of the self, then there is a certain kind of problem that enters, which is the split between the practice of becoming and the knowledge of the cosmos and the self in relation to the cosmos.
Okay, thank you very much.
Shall we read the next paragraph? Dan Wood, would you like to start?
Sure. But, in fact, the cause of this impression must necessarily be sought not in anything illusory or fantastic in the supreme or the universal self-existence, but in our own inability to seize the supreme clue to its manifold existence or discover the secret plan and pattern of its action. The self-existent is the infinite, and its way of being and of action must be the way of the infinite. But our consciousness is limited, our reason built upon things finite. It is irrational to suppose that a finite consciousness and reason can be a measure of the infinite. This smallness cannot judge that immensity. This poverty, bound to a limited use of its scanty means, cannot conceive the opulent management of those riches. An ignorant half-knowledge cannot follow the motions of an all-knowledge. Our reasoning is based upon our experience of the finite operations of physical nature, on an incomplete observation and uncertain understanding of something that acts within limits. It has organized on that basis certain conceptions which it seeks to make general and universal, and whatever contradicts or departs from these conceptions it regards as irrational, false, or inexplicable. But there are different orders of the reality and the conceptions, measures, standards, suitable to one knee, not to be applicable to another order. Our physical being is built first upon an aggregate of infinitesimals, electrons, atoms, molecules, cells. But the law of action of these infinitesimals does not explain all the physical workings, even of the human body, much less can they cover all the law and process of action of man's supraphysical parts, his life movements and mind movements and soul movements. In the body, finites have been formed with their own habits, properties, characteristic ways of action. The body itself is a finite, which is not a mere aggregate of these smaller finites, which it uses as parts, organs, constituent instruments of its operations. It has developed a being and has a general law which surpasses its dependence upon these elements or constituents. The life and mind, again, are superphysical finites with a different and more subtle mode of operation of their own, and no dependence on the physical parts for instrumentation can annul their intrinsic character. There is something more and other in our vital and mental being, and vital and mental forces than the functioning of a physical body. But again, each finite is in its reality, or has behind it an infinite, which has built and supports and directs the finite it has made as its self-figure. So that even the being and law and process of the finite cannot be totally understood without a knowledge of that which is occult within or behind it. Our finite knowledge, conceptions, standards may be valid within their limits, but they are incomplete and relative. A law founded upon an observation of what is divided in space and time cannot be confidently applied to the being and action of the indivisible. Not only can it not be applied to the spaceless and timeless infinite, but it cannot be applied even to a time infinite or a space infinite. A law and process binding for our superficial being need not be binding on what is occult within us. Again, our intellect, founding itself on reason, finds it difficult to deal with what is infrarational. Life is infrarational, and we find that our intellectual reason applying itself to life is constantly forcing upon it a control, a measure, an artificial Procrustean rule that either succeeds in killing or petrifying life, or constrains it into a rigid forms and conventions that lame and imprison its capacity, or ends by a bungle, a revolt of life, a decay or disruption of the systems and superstructures built upon it by our intelligence. An instinct, an intuition is needed, which the intellect has not at its command and does not always listen to when it comes in of itself to help the mental working. But still more difficult must it be for a right reason to understand and deal with the suprarational. The suprarational is the realm of the spirit, and in the largeness, subtlety, profundity, complexity of its movement, the reason is lost. Here, intuition and inner experience alone are the guide. Or if there is any other, it is that which intuition is only a sharp edge, an intense projected ray. The final enlightenment must come from the suprarational true consciousness, from a supramental vision and knowledge.
So Sri Aurobindo starts over here by trying to show us that this idea of either the everything having to follow a certain kind of rigid law, understandable order that the mind can discover, or its opposite, that is a certain kind of magic, see, that doesn't have any explanation. Both these belong to our normal state of existence and consciousness. That is our finitude. This is again a very, very key point, and I think he holds to that idea throughout this paragraph, which is the notion of the finite confronted by the infinite. And there is a certain kind of paradox in that relationship. And the paradox arises particularly because the finite is itself the infinite. It's a self-presentation of the infinite. And that's where the relationship is very hazy, and we move into what might be called a logic of the infinite. And a logic of the infinite is always a paradoxical logic. This paradoxical logic, which is almost a contradiction in terms, is something which is necessary to properly describe the relation between the infinite and the finite. And so that's the first thing he begins with, that we cannot look for an answer in finite structures of the reason. We cannot reasonably reconstruct the indivisible. And this is something which, you know, even at the edges of modern science, we are confronted with, that there are certain things that are inexplicable. They are the weird phenomena of nature at certain scales. And those weird phenomena arise exactly because there is an incompatibility of kind, not of degree anymore. That it is the indivisible and the divided that are face to face, and the interface between the two is either a kind of a magic, as he says over there, or a kind of a paradoxical self-appearance that needs to be understood in terms of the logic of the infinite. So that's where Sri Aurobindo is coming out with this particular paragraph, and to help us, he's essentially pointing to the development of the intuition. And earlier he has said that the reason for that is that each of these entities that seem to be separated and divided, and the cosmos that seems to include them as parts in a system, maybe an ecosystem, are self-appearances of the Infinite One. And hence each of them carries within itself an intuition and a force, which is the intuition in action, that is making it do what it is doing. And the cosmos, the chaosmos, if we may call it that, is really something that arises due to that intuition at work. The fact that every entity is ultimately the one which is reconstructing its oneness out of an appearance of self-division. That fact is what creates the cosmos and creates the entities within the cosmos, and their steady emergence from level to level of being. So he points out how, you know, this notion of aggregated matter, which is creating the body, the physical body, yields a level of being which cannot be explained by the sum total of the constituents. And yet, even these constituents, which seem to be so predictable, once we really look down upon them with care, we find that they are not as predictable as they seem. They maintain a kind of appearance of predictability. There seems to be a force which they contain, which is making them behave in a certain way, or we may even go further and say each of them is a force that is behaving by intuition in a certain way. It's intuition all the way down, if we start looking at it like that. That there is a certain creativity to every entity that also implies its oneness with everything else. And it is this that is re-emerging from bottom up, gradually, more and more. So, you know, in a way, again, I mean, since I've drawn this comparison before, I'd like to bring to notion the sort of change that is taking place, that in many of the modern ways of thinking are reappearing. And it's reappearing in science, but it's also reappearing in philosophy, which is teaching a new way of care for the soul, a new way of becoming. And people like Deleuze, who I've mentioned before, are speaking about the fact that either we can look at reality as already formed at whatever level, whether the atom or the body or rocks and stones or nations, when we talk about society and start looking at kind of, you know, social formations, each of these is a self-presentation of something which is ultimately indescribable and yet which is one. It is a single voice, university, that is expressing itself through these agglomerations and conglomerations. So the conglomerations, he uses the term molecular. In other words, it's just like molecules are born out of the combination of atoms. These formations are held together by certain forces, yet they are not primary. Each one of these, say the human body or the human being or society, is made up of constituents, and the consciousness can actually look upon itself as not primary but formed. So behind the molecular is the molar, and we have to look at it as both at the same time, that it is formed and unformed at the same time. So that's what he's getting at over here, that these finites that appear are based upon an infinite. It's really the infinite that is presenting itself as the finite. And he's also saying that this appearance of order is something that is more prominent at the more material levels. But as we become expressive of more conscious forms, the form of life, the form of mind, we find less and less determinability. It becomes more and more free and independent, in other words. And then he introduces these very powerful concepts here. Each finite is in its reality, or has behind it, an infinite which has built and supports and directs the finite it has made as its self-figure. And this goes all the way down to even the material predictable constituents known as atoms. So that even the being and law and process of the finite cannot be totally understood without a knowledge of that which is occult within or behind it. Our finite knowledge conception standards may be valid within their limits, but they are incomplete and relative. a law founded upon an observation of what is divided in space and time cannot be confidently applied to the being and action of the indivisible. This is the key line in this entire paragraph, the most powerful line. And then he points out that not only it cannot be applied to the spaceless and timeless infinite, but it cannot be applied even to a time infinite or a space infinite. See, that is the thing about the infinite self-presentation. The infinite self-presentation is occurring through the creation of the dimensions of space and time. And yet these are also self-presentations, and hence each one of these is an infinite. And our experience sort of falsifies all of these. Ultimately, we consider ourselves to be bound in time because we appear and we disappear. Even the body appears and disappears. And hence there is a sense that the entire cosmos is made up of these finite appearances and disappearances in time and these finitudes of space that each entity occupies. But he's saying that true experience is that the dimensions of time and space are themselves self-presentations of the timeless and spaceless infinite, and therefore a space infinity and a time infinity. And each entity that appears in space and time is ultimately a space infinity and a time infinity and a spaceless and timeless infinity. And that is something which, he's inviting our intuition to come to understand. Finally, the entire paragraph is really drawing on one of the conclusions he makes at the end of the previous chapter, which is that though we appear to be finite in time and place, and use our minds in a logical fashion, cutting things up into these appearances and tying them together through logic, yet there is something occult, that's the point he's making, the occult reality, which is conscious, and hence the intellect can connect with that. And in connecting with that, it articulates the intuition that is that of the self-determination of the one in each of its appearances.
If there are no questions, Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. But the being and action of the infinite must not be therefore regarded as if it were a magic void of all reason. There is, on the contrary, a greater reason in all the operations of the infinite, but it is not a mental or intellectual. It is a spiritual and supramental reason. There is a logic in it because there are relations and connections infallibly seen and executed. What is magic to our finite reason is the logic of the infinite. It is a greater reason, a greater logic, because it is more vast, subtle, complex in its operations. It comprehends all the data which our observation fails to seize. It deduces from them results which neither our deduction nor induction can anticipate, because our conclusions and inferences have a meager foundation and are fallible and brittle. If we observe a happening, we judge and explain it from the result, and from a glimpse of its most external constituents, circumstances, or causes. But each happening is the outcome of a complex nexus of forces which we do not and cannot observe, because all forces are to us invisible. But they are not invisible to the spiritual vision of the infinite. Some of them are actualities working to produce or occasion a new actuality. Some are possibles that are near to the pre-existent actuals and in a way included in their aggregate. But there can intervene always new possibilities that suddenly become dynamic potentials and add themselves to the nexus. And behind all are imperatives or an imperative which these possibilities are laboring to actualize. Moreover, out of the same nexus of forces, different results are possible. What will come out of them is determined by a sanction which was no doubt waiting and ready all the time, but seems to come rapidly to intervene and alter everything, a decisive divine imperative. All this our reason cannot grasp because it is the instrument of an ignorance with a very limited vision and a small stock of accumulated and not always very certain or reliable knowledge, and because, too, it has no means of direct awareness. For this is the difference between intuition and intellect, that intuition is born of a direct awareness, while intellect is an indirect action of a knowledge which constructs itself with difficulty out of the unknown from signs and indications and gathered data. But what is not evident to our reason and senses is self-evident to the infinite consciousness. And if there is a will of the infinite, it must be a will that acts in this full knowledge and is the perfect spontaneous result of a total self-evidence. It is neither a hampered evolutionary force bound by what it has evolved, nor an imaginative will acting in the void upon a free caprice. It is the truth of the infinite affirming itself in the determinations of the finite.
Yeah, here he is trying to make the case for a logic of the infinite, as he says, and that logic of the infinite is much more complex than what we can comprehend using our reason. And that's the main point that he's making to the awakening of a intuition which connects our intellect to that logic, the logic of the infinite. And he's pointing out to the fact that phenomenal understanding, the understanding of phenomena from the surface, particularly through the sense empirical evidence, doesn't capture that which lies behind. And that's why it's very important to connect the empirical to the forces that lie behind it. And he points to the fact that even those forces are not absolute. The forces, the actualities of existence are a nexus of possibilities, these possibles. And these possibles ultimately also have two levels to them. There are possibles that are hypothetical possibles, and there are possibles that become what he calls dynamic potentials. These three levels, the world of actualities, and he's actually building in a way that sort of bridge between the visible and the invisible, in pointing to this fact that the phenomenal universe, which is the universe of what we call actualities, has behind it ultimately an infinite variability, the world of infinite possibility. And in between the two, there are certain other levels that come in. One is this level of what he calls dynamic potentials. The dynamic potentials intervene between the field of absolute possibility and the actualities. And they intervene because there is a certain kind of ordering, patterning to the way in which infinite possibility is appearing in the cosmos. And yet, these are also never fully determined. That there, even the dynamic potentials are constantly being revised by new interventions, appearances of new kinds of forces and possibilities which were not present before. So this is ultimately this description, the first part of that paragraph, puts us face to face with the notion of a chaotic universe, chaotic cosmos, a cosmos that's constantly changing, that is magic, pure magic, cannot be predicted at all. Yet, what he's saying is that what makes it all coherent is the fact that each of these entities is secretly everything else, that everything is interdependent on everything else, which is one explanation. For example, the Buddhist explanation of codependent arising. In other words, for anything to appear, everything that is in it must also coexist with it. And it's almost as if it's implicit in it. So this kind of a codependent arising implies the knowledge of the others in the one, in its own self-arising. And on the other hand, there is something even more profound, that is, that it's not merely a codependent arising, but it is a monism that is known through and through by each of its elements. Each of its elements is the entirety that is self-manifesting. And this is ultimately what allows us to understand this logic of the infinite, to bridge the phenomenal intelligence to the logic of the intellect, one needs to develop the intuition of consciousness. And that's the point he's making here.
Devashish, I have a question. What that, what you were saying about the what's behind, about the phenomenal universe having behind it infinite possibilities, sounds to me a lot like how quantum physics looks at the arising of reality. And is it, have you observed the relationship between this philosophy and that scientific thinking?
Indeed, I mean that is one of the modern ways of thinking, because there we begin moving into a new description of reality, because once one looks at the you know, the kind of scale of the absolute nano a world, and or one goes into the other scale of the, you know, astrophysical world, one starts encountering these weird phenomena. So that's where the question of the indivisible and the divided becomes a real paradox. And so to explain that, instead of using a deterministic language, a new kind of mathematics has arisen. And that is the mathematics of statistical quantum mechanics. And so we can certainly say that that is one of the descriptions that is attempting to bridge this notion of a world which is actual with the world which is possible, you know, the world of probabilities and appearances. I'm not that much of a... I mean, expert or familiar with it, but I mean, I draw on somebody. If anybody else wishes to address this issue, we'd be happy to listen to it. So, but yes, I mean, that's certainly one of the languages that is appearing to try and bridge these realities. You know, then there's this whole chaos theory, which also is trying to, you know, do the same from a more, because chaos theory approaches not merely from the level of material reality, the world as we know it in terms of matter, but in terms of vital reality, the world of life and the world of mind. So to acknowledge the fact that our existence has all these different layers to it is also very important. And, you know, chaos theory comes up with this notion of autopoiesis, which is, you know, self-regulating entities that develop a certain life of their own, which may be limited in time and place, but nevertheless that has a certain force within it that tries to maintain its functions as an unit and survive and become eternal, in fact. So these drives are intrinsic even at levels of freedom which are not so determined. See, so we find that these are the kind of laws of the infinite, we may say, which are intervening between the field of infinite possibility and the world of actualities. Deleuze calls it the virtual. So he says that there is, it's just like he's saying, these dynamic potentia. The world of dynamic potentia is the virtual. And then there is the actual. And behind the virtual, there is the absolute.
So when I've heard of autopoiesis, it's actually been advanced as a modification of Darwin's theory, and that evolution doesn't occur simply because of the competition of the fittest, but it actually cooperates to form new beings, which respond to different kinds of stimuli and environmental situations, and so that the randomness is much reduced, and they did some studies to determine how long, you know, by random development, how long it would take to have the kinds of evolution that according to the Darwin theory of the fittest, and just determined that it's happening much faster. And that was the basis for taking a look at this. So there's the last that I knew of, I'm sure it's much more evolved now, but it's a while back, there were some South American scientists that were working with this. And I can't think of the woman's name.
Yeah, it is Maturana and Varela.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
They're some of the really important figures in this autopoiesis theory. And you're absolutely right. That's exactly what it is. I mean, it's, on the one hand, it is the ability to come into cooperative groups to increase the possibilities of survival. But this survival is not merely a survival of the fittest, but it's really a drive to express something which is, an entity consciousness. That's why they call it, the later philosophers, people like Guattari, etc., connect the notion of individuation with it. That it is the becoming individual of the cosmos that is expressed through it. What is the principle that is being expressed through this kind of autopoiesis, through the cooperative instinct of entities that sort of build adaptation machines, you may say, that are self-regulating and that can survive for longer periods and adapt to their environment. There is a drive to individuation. And this drive to individuation is increasing in complexity and in its sense of unity. Ultimately, this, I would call it the drive to the integral. It's the drive towards the integral that is expressed in autopoiesis. And also, I don't know whether Maturana and Varela used this term, but several of the later thinkers have used the term negentropy. That is a force negating entropy, negative force, a sort of an anti-entropic force that is expressing in the cosmos through autopoiesis.
So on that topic, what is your take on, like, you know, the association, if any, between this concept of entropy and integrality?
See, again, it may be better if a physicist discusses this, but basically an entropic state is a state where no activity can take place. It's called the heat death of the universe. Because in a way, everything has degraded to a point where it's an infinite waste. It's like the infinite wasteland. Its power, its potency to be able to, you know, interact has degraded to such a point that has happened. While in this case, an anti-entropic force would be something that is constantly trying to build a power of unity, which ultimately kind of contends against this power of entropy, entropic force, which would be something like an infinite chaos. To contend against it, a infinite coherence. That infinite coherence, notion of infinite coherence, is the integral, where everything knows itself to be everything else, and at the same time, it is in ordered relation with everything else. It forms a unit. It forms a constituted, being. And so this self-constitution of the one, or what one might call the reconstitution of the one, if we think of it in terms of the sacrifice of Purusha, which is one of the most primary anthropological myths behind this kind of an explanation of the cosmos, of an emerging order in the cosmos, that would be the integral. So this integrality is the knowledge aspect of the supreme. Since we are talking of an indeterminable infinite, that yet can present itself through a self-perception which is knowledgeable. How can it know itself? Sri Aurobindo has a phrase somewhere where he says, I'm not interested in how men can know God, but in how God knows himself. So you see, this is the main point of the supermind as the organ of integral knowledge, because it is that by which the radically infinite can present itself to itself as a ordered form, formless form, you may say that. So that is the integral, and I think negentropy is the affirmation of that integral.
So this brings up, especially with talking about autopoiesis and negentropy, brings up the idea of how groups, of what is a group in this integral consciousness, and what is the, it seems like I guess I think of the ocean and waves, and how each of these negentropies and each of these processes or emergence of autopoiesis express the entire integral consciousness, but in infinite ways. So is a group then just one of the infinite ways of the integral?
Yeah, no doubt, absolutely. A group is another way because, as we are saying, that you know, entities emerge with a finite form in space, but the negentropic impulse goes beyond that, and in the cooperation of entities, we have something which may not necessarily be so bounded even in space, that may actually, as we are doing right now, be a sort of a non-local, you know, conglomerate. And so those kinds of groups are still, in a sense, cooperating and trying to form certain, you know, units. Now, what is that unit expressing? This becomes the question. Only at a certain point, a unit becomes an individual. Before that, it is only a kind of a temporary convenience. So groups also have those two. What is it expressing? To what extent is it expressing the one? To what extent is it self-conscious as the one? To what extent has the one become self-conscious in the group? At that point, it becomes an individual. We may also say that it's exactly at that point that a soul is born in it. When we talk about group souls or nation souls, etc., these things also have a certain kind of a temporal life. They come into existence. And once they come into existence, they try to maintain themselves because there is a certain quality of eternity that pertains to the notion of the intuition of the self. So the self-regulation occurs at that level. But at the same time, it is, you know, contending against the force of entropy. So we find that just as the individual is bounded in time and place, particularly in time, it appears and disappears, and yet something in it persists. This is the basis of the theory of reincarnation, where Sri Aurobindo is essentially saying that one life is too short to arrive at any established sense of integrality in the individual. And the individual, whether at the level of the atom or at the level of the molecule, the level of the human being, or at the level of society and its groups, as you're talking about, each one of these, at the point where it becomes a certain individual, it individuates, that's where the whole notion of individuation is coming up, turns autopoietic. And at that point, we may connect the theory of autopoiesis to what Sri Aurobindo is talking about and say at that point, a soul appears. In other words, the self-presentation of the infinite one becomes a self-presentation. And so that individuated entity is going to express its own eternity in some way. And it expresses it through reincarnation. It returns again and again. And each time it tries to build its resources of power and integrality so that it can ultimately express its eternity in a single body, in a body which is so plastic that it can accommodate all the forces and is integral because of that.
May I say something here?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. That is first, I mean, in my opinion, I mean, it, as I can understand it, rather not opinion, is that all these autopoiesis and negentropy and entropy, heat death, thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, disorderliness, grouping, species, everything, I mean, like, all these things are basically models. So these are models. I mean, it's like a sort of attempt to understand the way world is organized as it is today. That said, it doesn't really know the future, and it doesn't really know the source. So it is sort of looking at things and you know, sort of trying to, I'm not trying to sort of downplay the humongous, I mean, you know, discoveries, but I'm just saying, like, if we want to use the word integral, I mean, as I understand it, it's way above these models. These are just, you know, models of today, which can be not applicable tomorrow. So, if we grow in, I mean, consciousness, the whole need, our whole model can change drastically. For example, like entropy is based on the hierarchy of natural energy and natural sources, which started with Big Bang. Like, why, you know, more matter came into place as opposed to antimatter. So, I mean, it's like the inequality or unequal concentration, as Shravindo puts it, as Shravindo writes, who is sort of, you know, starts or sort of indicates the source of these, all these structures, that we need unequal concentrations in order to sustain life, because life needs a dynamic flow, or a flow from higher to lower, like, you know, from colder to hotter, or wind blows from, you know, from one certain temperature to another temperature. These are basically related to this entropy, you know, and so, I mean, of course, also negentropy. But of course, negentropy, as I understand it, is actually indicates, it's not very recent. It starts from Schrödinger, or maybe more, maybe before him, not sure. But, I mean, it sort of tries to look at the hidden principle of life itself, not even the integrality of consciousness, which is yet to be reached, but life itself has many hidden mechanisms which are yet to be discovered. So, even this autopoiesis also is like an, you know, that life finds its way, that sort of thing. So, but consciousness can totally, reverse the need and the formula of existence. Like, we may totally base on something else. And may not necessarily be depending on this unequal concentration or inequality of nature's energy and stuff. So that's just my two cents, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree that these things are models. Of course, everything is a concept or a model. And actually, the models express certain things to certain degrees, and models keep changing. But this is also true that models are more or less adequate to reality. And certain models lend themselves. It's just like trying to arrive at an eternal or immortal body. If the body is plastic enough, then it can do it. But if it is rigid, it will break at some point. So history of model making is also like that. It has constantly tried to become more and more plastic so that it allows greater principles to express themselves. And at this point, I think these type of models like that of autopoiesis, etc., that's the reason why philosophers have taken it up and not... It was begun by people like life scientists and social scientists, but it has moved into philosophy, particularly because it's plastic enough to lend itself to the emergence of consciousness. It's a philosophy of emergence. It's the emergence of higher principles, not just of life, but of mind and later of pure consciousness. So what is it that is determining these autopoietic entities? Ultimately, it's a self-determination. So there has to be some power of self-determination. The power of self-determination can only come from a single consciousness, a conscious being. So this is the reason why some of these have much greater potency than other concepts that have gone before. And so I think that's...
Yes, of course. I mean, like, autopoiesis, I mean, that's... what I meant is that the life principle itself, we don't know enough. So that's why these things really, you know... of course, life principle also is sourced at that one being. But I'm saying we are still studying. We still do not know the entire life principle itself. But I'm saying life is one of the principles. I mean, there are many other grades of consciousness from Shravindu's view. I mean, which of course works as a backdrop of all these life principles as well. I mean, all these things are connected. But what I mean is that these things that we are talking about, of course, are supported by that integral consciousness. It may not be the integral consciousness, meaning it is one principle which still can show us new ways of manifesting itself. But it is not the entirety of it, I mean.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, what is the entirety is really how everybody, you know, how we configure the concept. That's ultimately what it is. I mean, nobody has given us a concept that is dead-ended. These concepts are also evolving. So the notion of the integral, ultimately the idea of the integral as the power behind evolution, is whether we look at it anthropologically or whether we look at it evolutionarily, the notion of the integral is ultimately what is behind the entire becoming. Becoming is nothing if not integral. It is integral from the very beginning and it is integral in its end, in its goal. And so, you know, if we create concepts to explain something which is at a lower level, that is fine, that works over there. But the big question is, does it work beyond that? And does it lend itself to something, does it lend itself to the emergence of greater principles? I think that's where the importance of these concepts come. And so that's the reason why philosophers have talked about things like this and in ways that border integrality, not just about the life principle, but principles that are emerging out of life, including pure consciousness.
Sure, I agree. Yeah.
We're also kind of using that word integral also to, like by its definition, we're using it to mean the end goal, right?
Now, I am using it, or Sri Aurobindo is using it, and not even as an end goal, because as he's saying, it is the end goal of this present condition of the cosmos. It's one stage, or one kind of critical stage, as he's saying, the passing out of our present phase into the knowledge phase is, through the integral. One may go beyond the integral. But that is the present goal, you may say. He's using it, or I'm using it because he's using it, but I wouldn't say that is understood to be the goal of reality and its becoming. But it's something that we envisage, because if there is a single thing that exists, then it can present itself to itself as a complex unity, which knows itself as such in each of its elements. So that coherence, where every element knows itself to be nothing but the one in itself and in all its own others, every other is itself ultimately. That kind of self-knowledge is the integral. And that kind of self-knowledge can emerge in a becoming which is completely coherent. It moves towards that. But it's also something that is fully conscious. Conscious of the totality in each of its elements. So that kind of a goal is what Sri Aurobindo is talking about, but not necessarily everybody else. Yet, if you push these kinds of ideas, concepts of negentropy, concepts of autopoiesis, they're almost bordering on that. It's very easy to see how one can reconfigure these concepts to address the integral.
I agree with you. I was also meaning that in the circle that, I mean, in the context of this discussion or in the context of a conversation among, quote unquote followers of Sri Aurobindo, it becomes the end goal. I agree with what you're saying. Given it's closing in on 9:45, shall we stop for today and continue next time?
Yeah, sure. So we are stopping at the paragraph. Next time we are going to begin with, it is evident that such a consciousness and will.
Sure.
Okay, so I think we can end over here today. And Happy New Year to everybody. I think the next time we convene, it'll be 2015,
oh.
A new year.
If there is interest, would you be open to doing something on the first morning? Do you think it'll be interesting to enough people? Given that the first is a Thursday and most likely people are off, if there's interest, we can do something perhaps.
I'm open to it. Let's see. I'll think about it a little and we can send a notice out.
Yeah, sure. Sorry to bring it up right at the last moment.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll watch out for your email around it in the coming days.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Devashish.
Okay, thanks.
Happy New Year.
Okay, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.